Gabbard Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Joining us now, senior CBS business analyst Jill Schlesinger. First of all, do we have to worry about higher gas prices because of this attack on Saudi Arabia, Jill?
Yes. Isn't that terrible? But I don't think it'll be long term, but I think that it's pretty clear that if crude oil and Brent oil are up, almost 10%, and if that persists for a few days, that will certainly flow through at the pumps. Remember, a gallon of gas, two-thirds of that price is based on the actual price of oil. So if the conditions persist, if the Saudis can't get enough production back online, it will be higher prices for a longer period. But as soon as that production is back to the pre-strike point, then prices will come down. But as you remember, prices usually go up a lot faster than they go down, right?
Right. Don't American oil producers, tend to gain from this when the price of oil is pushed up?
Yeah, they can. The problem that we face in the U.S. is that while we might be awash in various forms of energy, we don't necessarily have the infrastructure to export this, to make up what is being lost from the world market. So I think eventually this would be one of those kind of supply and demand situations where we turn on our spigots. It's just that our spigots are on. We just can't get the oil to the rest of the world.
Now, I noticed that the European Central Bank, and I don't know why, you know, we need to care about it, but I find it interesting that they are now promising depositors a negative interest rate where I deposit $100 in the European Central Bank and a year later they give me back $99.
Isn't that great?
And for some reason, somebody would do that.
Well,
now, we've tried to explain this several times, Jill.
Okay.
And so I'm giving you another opportunity to explain why any rational thinking banker would want to take that deal.
Well, let's say there was no better alternative than to keep your money with your central bank. In other words, let's say that you're worried about global growth, you're worried about growth in the European Union, and you're worried about the impact of Brexit on the European Union. Mm-hmm. And also add to that that because companies are also having those exact same concerns, they don't actually want to borrow money. Then you're sort of left with this lousy deal, which is, okay, central bank, I'll pay you. I'm a big financial institution. I'll pay a little bit of money just to hang on to my money. And that's really the bargain that's being struck. I think the bigger question is, if things went south in the United States, would the U.S. central bank ever resort to negative interest rates?
And would that mean that everybody whose retirement account is invested in treasuries, for example, actually starts losing money instead of making money?
Not necessarily. I mean, remember, what is a central bank doing? The central bank is actually saying to the institution, here's where you keep our money. It's the institution's choice as to whether or not it will then in turn say to the consumer or the investor that they're going to have that same deal. I think for most people, the idea would be that if this ever were to occur, that most banks would just eat the difference. They would not want anyone be paying
them. But in any case, this is definitely a drag on interest rates, on people who want some kind of guaranteed return on their money. It means that you're still going to be in the pathetic, 1% to 2% range?
Yeah, I mean, pathetic, it doesn't sound like the right word because 2% sounds a lot better than it was 0.1 just about 5 years ago.
True.
So I think the problem is that if you're a saver and we're going to have a Federal Reserve meeting this week and you see the headline that goes by, the Fed cuts rates by a quarter of a point, it's now 1.75 to 2%, you're going to very quickly see that your savings rates, whether it's your savings account, your checking account, your money market, those will go down. And so, unfortunately, savers are often punished in a declining interest rate environment.
But this also would be good news for the U.S. Treasury, right? Because we have this incredible debt, which is growing at $1 trillion a year. It means we don't have to pay much interest on that, right?
Yes, you can be happy as a taxpayer, sad as a saver, happy as a borrower, maybe sad as an investor, because what is the Fed doing when it's cutting interest rate? It's telegraphing to us that the economy is slowing down. And when the economy slows down, it's not really great news. So yeah, it might be a little bit of a sugar high to keep the markets up right now. And by the way, all three major indexes on Friday closed within 1% of their all-time highs. Doesn't really feel like that. But in essence, if the economy is slowing down, that's really never good news for anyone.
This sounds like financial schizophrenia to me, but I guess that's the world that we live in, isn't it?
I don't know. I'm sort of thinking that it's not just the world, but I mean, it could just sort of be life. That's just where we are.
There's that too. And by the way, no special recession warnings flashing on your dashboard?
No, not really. I mean, look, last week we got a good report out from retail sales that consumers are spending money. And so I think the big concern when you have an oil price spike, you have the strike at a GM plant, you have sort of this sort of constant churn of volatility, big ups, big downs, that can eat into confidence. And that could actually impact how consumers behave. So, you know, we're 100 days from Christmas, my man. 100 wow. days. That's and great. We need consumers to still feel pretty good for the next 100 days.
CBS Senior Business Analyst Jill Schlesinger. Jill, thank you.
Take care.
Well, that is scary, isn't it? Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Is there an age at which a human being is too old to handle the pressures of being president? Let's consult the doctor.
Paging Dr. Cohen.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. So just to set the scene here, we have Bernie Sanders, who on Election Day 2020 would be 79 years, 1 month old. We have Joe Biden, on Election Day 2020, would be very close to 78 years old. Elizabeth Warren, who would be 71 years, 4 months old. And, of course, the president, who would be 74 and a half. So, based on what we know about aging, Dr. Cohen, is there an age where someone's just too old to handle the job of the presidency?
Well, that's a really interesting question, and I think there's really two parts to it. The first part is, will somebody survive the presidency? And, in fact, we look at their age and their gender. The chances of Bernie Sanders surviving a four-year term are actually 76.8%. Biden has a chance of surviving a four-year term of 79.2%. And Trump himself has an 84.8% chance of surviving. And Elizabeth Warren has a 91.8% chance. So actually, the chances are pretty good. Now, where do these numbers come from? They come from something called actuarial tables that actually show the probability of a person dying at a certain age or before their next birthday. And these statistics actually calculate the remaining life expectancy for people at different ages and the probability of them surviving to a particular year of age. And because men and women have different mortality rates, actuarial life tables are actually computed separately for men and women. And you may have heard of them because this is what insurance companies use to sell life insurance. Now, the second part to this question is not only whether or not somebody would survive, what are the chances of them developing dementia? The risk of Alzheimer's disease, the most common form of dementia or vascular dementia, and several other dementias, they go up significantly with advancing age. But importantly, genetics and family history play a very, very important role. We're understanding that more and more as time goes by. Now, also the way you take care of yourself. So smoking and alcohol use, recent studies have found that smoking significantly increases the risk of mental decline and dementia. And people who smoke have a higher risk of atherosclerosis. And this can lead to vascular disease, which can be the underlying cause of vascular dementia. Underlying that is cholesterol. So having high levels of cholesterol, specifically LDL or low density lipoprotein or the bad form of cholesterol, appears to significantly increase a person's risk of developing vascular dementia. And some research has actually also linked high cholesterol to an increased risk in actually Alzheimer's disease.
Now, these and other things that are just the normal developments of age, can these be picked up in a routine physical exam?
Yes, they can be picked up in a routine physical exam, and that's why we have our presidents get checked or our presidential candidates get checked. And now, the thing is it's interesting because people who are more educated and people who have a higher socioeconomic status actually live longer. If you look at any given age in an actuarial table, there's actually sort of a bell-shaped curve that's on either side of that given age. These candidates, because they're all educated, they're all very high functioning people. They all really have means, even Bernie Sanders. And so these people all actually shift the curve to the right. They fall outside the median or the mean for the actuarial table, and they actually have a greater likelihood of surviving and not developing dementia because of those underlying factors.
Mm-hmm. So would it be a good idea to require that they each undergo a physical exam from not their own physician, but a disinterested third party?
Well, that's actually a really interesting thought. I've never thought of that before. Or maybe, brainstorming on it, maybe a panel of physicians.
Yes.
Yeah, because the thing is this, though, your physician does know you best as long as you see your physician on a regular basis. However, you know, medicine is very sophisticated today, and there's lots of tests that could be done to actually evaluate an individual candidate. The problem we have is if we have some information, how do we actually translate that into real risk? And a lot of tests fall into a gray zone. Most of the time when we do tests, they do fall into a gray zone when we're trying to just get a physical. So it's hard to say somebody actually has risk. Even with John McCain, who'd had cancer previously, he had already gone beyond the 5 years of survival. But how does that actually translate into even longer term survival? And we don't really have a very good answer for that.
So would you want to sit on a panel like that, or would that just be a little bit too hot?
I'd love to sit on a panel like that.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Dr. Cohen, thanks very much.
Thanks, Dave.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Would you like to see your healthcare premiums drop by 10%? And you say, Dave, how can we do that? Well, it might happen if insurance companies would prosecute fraud once in a while. We've talked from time to time to Marshall Allen, who is investigative reporter at ProPublica. He is on a crusade, a relentless crusade, to cut the cost of doctor visits and drugs and healthcare in general. And lately, Marshall, you've been looking into the fact that private insurance companies, very likely the ones that insure you through your employer, just don't care about insurance fraud, and they assume that you will eat the cost. What did you find?
Well, Dave, thank you so much for having me on your show. I mean, like you said, I'm very frustrated by how much we all spend for our healthcare benefits if we get them through our employers. And usually those benefits are managed by an insurance company. Either the insurance company has their own insurance plan, or they administer a plan for an employer that pays for the benefits themselves. And everyone talks about healthcare fraud as this massive problem. And in the Medicare plans and the Medicaid plans, the government plans, you hear a lot about prosecution. In fact, you know, journalists are always getting press releases from the government saying, we nailed this doctor, we nailed this hospital for Medicare fraud. But I was like, when do you ever hear about fraud being enforced in the employer-sponsored world? And I knew from that other story that we talked about 2 months ago, about that personal trainer in Texas who was committing fraud. And he wasn't even a doctor. He just passed himself off as a doctor.
And he billed something like, he billed millions of dollars.
$25 million.
Right? Yeah.
$25 million. He billed $25 million to Aetna, United, and Cigna, three of the biggest insurance companies in the country. And so I went on this quest to try and figure out how much really are the insurance companies doing to police fraud. And what I found is that they're not doing very much. I went to the state of California because it's a big state and it's really widely known that there's a lot of fraud in California. I called the DAs in the 14 largest counties in California, and those counties cover about 80% of the state's population. And I asked them, how often did you have a fraud case that was referred by a commercial health insurance company that led to criminal charges in 2017 and 2018? All told, in those 2 years, they filed charges in only 22 cases that came out of those commercial health insurance companies. And to put that into context, if you look at the Medicaid program, it covers about the same number of people. And during those 2 years, they filed charges in 321 cases. So you have 22 cases in the commercial market, you have 321 in the Medicaid market.
Well, I guess they're not motivated, Marshall, because I can't control what my employer charges me for health care. All I know is it's less than I pay on my own, so I cheerfully pay it. And the insurance companies, it's not like there's a lot of competition to be the lowest price insurance provider out there by cutting fraud. So, you know, where's the incentive to do it anyway?
Well, that's right. And also, they make more money the higher the costs go. And so it's not a coincidence, you know, that our healthcare costs have been going up every year for the last 20 years. If we look at how much our costs have gone up for our health benefits in the last 5 to 10 years, it goes up by 5 to 10% almost every year for almost every American. So this isn't like a coincidence. It was made this way, you know, and mm-hmm. we're in the perfect position because we're powerless and they can keep taking more of our money.
Well, suppose it was if the government's doing such a good job of enforcing and punishing fraud, why not have a government option? That might provide some incentive for the privates to bring their costs down.
Well, it would be fair if people had better options. And, you know, nobody holds up Medicare or Medicaid fraud enforcement as like the gold standard. I mean, everybody knows they have more fraud than they can handle.
At least they're trying,
But at least they're trying and at least there's accountability. And I talked to more than a dozen people who had worked as fraud investigators for the insurance companies. And they all told me that there's less fraud that they see in the Medicare and Medicaid markets, because the criminals know that they'll be prosecuted, or they could be excluded from Medicare if they start gaming the billing system. But that private insurance that we all paid for as workers, they don't have that same risk of being prosecuted. And so they see a lot more fraud in that area. And I've talked to people also, even who have emailed me in the last 24 hours, who worked inside the insurance companies and said, yeah, you wouldn't believe what I saw. I mean, they would just let these cases go.
Well, it just sounds messed up, Marshall.
It is that, Dave. And I think that, you know, what really needs to happen is that workers and employees need to be aware of this, and they need to go to their HR manager and their CFO and their CEO, and they need to actually calculate how much more they're spending now than they were, say, 5 years ago on their premiums, while their coverage has gotten worse. And they need to ask their bosses, hey, what are you doing about this? How do you know that the insurance company is actually doing their job and protecting our money? Because it is literally coming out of our pockets and out of our paychecks.
The headline for Marshall's story is, we asked prosecutors if health insurance companies care about fraud. They laughed at us. And they actually did, huh?
They actually did.
Marshall Allen, reporter from ProPublica. Thank you, Marshall. Keep it up.
Thanks, Dave. Appreciate it. All right. Have a great day.
Your daily dose of kindness now. A St. Louis mother of six is doing her part to feed more than just her own kids. For the last 5 years, KTVI says Champelle Anderson has fed a whole neighborhood of kids. She packs lunches in the morning, then waits for the kids to get off the bus and hands them out.
And it makes me proud, and I want to keep it going. My goal is to... I want to go to different neighborhoods.
And it doesn't stop at lunches either. Anderson has an open door policy on school days. They can knock on her door in the morning, too, for snacks or breakfast. She guesses she hands out around 100 meals a day. And as you heard, she wants to grow her act of kindness to other neighborhoods. She's aiming for 150 meals a day now. Baby steps. She says she lives by a quote from Mother Teresa. I alone cannot change the world, but I can cast a stone across the waters to create many ripples. And here's the amazing thing. So her local TV station first covered her act of kindness, because it is pretty amazing handing out 100 lunches a day to kids. And then that was picked up by network stations like ABC. And then the official GoFundMe accounts on social media picked up on her story to feature her. And her modest fundraising goal of $1,500 has grown to $56,000 now.
That's a lot of lunches.
I think she's going to do well with her program.
Time for the Sports Insider, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealer. And here he is, Danny O'Neill. Danny, over the years, you've taught me that the position of backup quarterback is a nothing burger. It's like being the vice president when the president's a really young guy. And so since the Seahawks won against the backup quarterback, ultimately, does yesterday's game really count?
Oh, absolutely it does. They won in Pittsburgh, where they haven't won in 20 years. They beat a Steelers team. They haven't scored a point there in either of their past two games. And they absolutely went out and played a really good game. Seattle should feel Ben Roethlisberger's absence didn't explain why Seattle's offense scored 28 points. Seattle should feel really encouraged by the way they've started. They're 2-0 for the first time since 2013, which was also the year they won the Super Bowl.
So the team, the Hawks, are really as good as they looked yesterday, despite the backup quarterback.
Yes, winning on the road early is an incredible accomplishment. Would it have meant more if Ben Roethlisberger played the whole game? Yeah, but at the same time, like, you play the Drew Brees, the Saints quarterback. He might be out this next week. Should Seattle apologize if they beat the Saints? Absolutely not.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because that news just came down that Drew Brees has a thumb injury that could cause him to miss up to 5 games.
Yeah, he hit his thumb on an opposing defensive lineman's hand, kind of on his follow-through. He left the game against the Rams. The Saints are going directly from L.A., where they played the Rams, to Seattle, and Brees was remaining behind in Los Angeles. And the concern is that he's injured ligaments in his thumb. And that's terrible news for the Saints and great news for the Seahawks if they're going to play either Teddy Bridgewater or Taysom Hill.
So their backups aren't as good as Gardner Minshew.
No, probably not. Gardner Minshew almost got him a win, didn't he? He sounded great. He looked great, and they ended up, it was just a 2-point conversion that kept them from winning that game.
All right, so they are 2-0. Now, I guess I should ask you, because you have predicted a so-so season, 10-6. You sticking with that?
No, it looks significantly better. And I'll say the guy that epitomizes that the most is DK Metcalf. I thought he might catch 20 passes as a rookie. He looks great. He's fantastic, and he's only going to get better from here. There's a lot of room to be really, really optimistic about this Seahawks season.
Will Disley, in our group, I knew who he was, but I was surprised how many people in our group said, Will who? Doesn't he have an amusement park someplace?
Disley.
Right.
He's a young man. He's in his second year out of Montana. He went to the University of Washington, where he started off as a defensive lineman. He ends up becoming last year. He had a great start through his first 4 games and suffered a really bad knee injury. And he looked great yesterday. In fact, he has spawned something of a catchphrase that I think should really try and catch on. I want to see if you can do it, Dave. There is a hip-hop song that talks about everybody in the club getting tipsy. And how about everybody in the club getting disley? Do you think you can try and recite that and see if that works for you? Come on, Dave.
Everybody in the club getting disley.
Get disley.
Yeah,
get
disley. There we go.
Everybody in the club catchy, get
right?
disley. All right. Put your hands up. Put your hands up.
He just raised the roof,
That's
Danny.
Right. That's
yeah.
right.
I just raised the roof. That's right, Colleen. That's what I did.
That was good. I'm proud of you.
Yeah, Dave and I
You're
are
really
about
committed.
To do the kid and play kick step next, Danny.
That'd be great. That'd be fantastic.
Danny, last week we talked a little bit about Ifedi. We had that great audio of Russell Wilson telling him, no, to stop him from getting a personal foul so they could get their touchdown. And I forget where I'm seeing it. It's probably somewhere on Twitter, somebody saying Ifedi continues to look like he's going to be a problem for the team. What did that mean?
Well, Ifedi's pass protection has always been a question. And I thought he took a step forward last season. But his ability to be able to hold up his end of it, and that question, I think their offensive line is pretty well sorted out, and he had some issues yesterday, specifically in pass protection, and I think that is a concern. He's always going to be a hot-headed player, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that. Seattle actually does pretty well. The guy who was their best right tackle before him, a guy named Breno Giacomini, was the guy that played at that edge, too. I don't think there's a problem with him being kind of the hothead. It's really the issue. He's got to get better in pass protection.
One question I had for you. Before Roethlisberger left the game, I counted after the snap. He always had a good 4, sometimes 5 seconds just to stand there with the football, looking around at who he wanted to pass to. And that never seems to happen with the Seahawks. Why not?
Well, there's two reasons. One is the Seahawks defense, specifically against Roethlisberger yesterday, did not blitz. They did not send pressure after him. Now, you're hoping to be able to get pressure on the quarterback rushing just 4 guys, but that doesn't always happen. Seattle opted to play coverage. Mm-hmm. The question and the issue with Russell Wilson having time, Pittsburgh is one of the most aggressive teams when it comes to blitzing. So that's really not quite an apples-to-apples comparison. And you saw yesterday Russell was able to tear up the blitz. And I think that's one of Russell's greatest strengths, is when other teams bring pressure, he makes them pay for it.
All right. Our sports insider, Danny O'Neill, sponsored by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Danny, thank you.
Thank you very much. Talk to you guys tomorrow.
The attacks in Saudi Arabia. The Saudi government is insisting this morning that those attacks were carried out using Iranian weapons. Let's bring in CBS military analyst and retired Army Major Mike Lyons. First of all, Saudi Arabia must have some pretty crummy defenses if 10 drones were able to get through, or is there something I'm missing here?
No, you're right, Dave. I mean, think about two numbers here. $68 billion is what Saudi Arabia pays for defense, and about 150 grand is what it costs for those drones to get through any air defense platform it had to hit, precisely hit, in fact, the critical infrastructure of that Aramco facility. I mean, this is as a result of better battery technology as well as better GPS and location technology. But the bottom line is, you know, you go back 20 years ago, that capability was not there to do either. Saudi Arabia, again, lack of foresight, recognizing that this is a threat. And I think this is going to really change the dynamic in terms of how countries are going to have to try to defend their critical infrastructure going forward.
Now, these are not hobby drones. These are, I saw some pictures of them. They seem to be like, what, about 6 feet long?
Yeah, they're not necessarily the commercial off-the-shelf ones you can buy. And, you know, they're not that type, because you've got to put enough explosives in them that they could both take flight and then also cause damage when they hit. So they're clearly nation state made. So this whole thing about the Houthis, to me, is just, you know, so much sort of a joke. They have no capability to manufacture these, and they could possibly buy them. But if they're buying them, they're manufactured by the Iranians or one of their enemies. And they're just really more or less a proxy for their use.
And Mike, the headlines seem to be really focused on the oil and the impact here. The president talking about, you know, freeing up some of our reserves. What I'm wondering, though, is if something like this, especially with the tensions already there between the U.S. and Iran, if this is leading us to something bigger and greater.
Yeah, Colleen, I think the last thing we should be doing is locking and loading, is what the president said. Look, we don't want to get into a shooting war over this. This is first and foremost a regional Saudi Arabia issue that they have to figure out. I think we've got to go back to the diplomacy table, take all this evidence that we have that says Iran was involved, get with our allies, put more pressure. It does fit in line with their strategy, given they're trying to disrupt the oil supply and just disrupt the price of oil in that part of the world. So it all falls in line. Now it comes back to getting diplomacy to work and sharing this intelligence with our allies and making sure that there's no conspiracy on this, because you can also argue from the Iranian side that the Saudis could have done this on purpose and it could be a way to escalate to get the United States involved.
Is Pompeo up for that task, the diplomacy?
Yeah, it's him plus his staff plus a lot of back channeling right now. This gets back to, depending on who you're reading in Washington, whether or not the U.S. has the legitimacy and the credibility with some of our allies and whether they want to get involved with this. And it all roads back to, leads back to the JCPOA and the nuclear issue, because, this is how Iran stays, in the forefront of those negotiations. If we can get the French and the British to realize that the Iranians are behind this, it provides leverage from a diplomatic perspective. I think that's the way we have to go, because, again, there's no military solution here that doesn't escalate very quickly.
Why would the other countries hesitate to act at this point? Hasn't Iran proven that they are indeed backing terrorists? Even if they're complying with the nuclear agreement, they are making trouble.
Yeah, my observation is Europe is going to Europe, and what that means is they're going to focus on their internal problems, and they can look the other way. They want the money that they know will come out of Iranian exports and goods and services that they'll be able to do with the Iranian government. So they'll come up with all these different excuses in order to try to stay above water. Germans, the French, and the British, in some ways. The British will stay likely more closely on our side on this. But, there's this thing that we're going to pay the Iranians $15 billion to come back into the deal. I mean, it's just ludicrous to think that the Trump administration is going to be that stupid to do something like that, given what he said about the previous administration getting into the deal
right
in the first place.
Exactly.
So I don't get it.
Speaking of stupid, didn't Iran also issue a threat saying, hey, we have missiles that can hit anything within 2,000 kilometers, and you asked some of your forces within 2,000 kilometers, suppose they shot first?
Well, that's true. They do. They have that capability. We know that they have that capability, and we're on alert, so to speak. I mean, we've got air defense systems on our ships. It'd be difficult to hit. That would escalate things very quickly, because if they decided to go after either a fixed target or one of our naval assets there, I'm sure we would respond 10 times over. Again, that's just, again, more bluster on their side to try to gain some kind of credibility at the negotiation table, I guess.
CBS News military analyst, retired Army Major Mike Lyons. Mike, thanks very much.
Thanks, guys.
I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News.
You can hear us live every morning on 97.3 FM or subscribe to this podcast and you'll never miss the show.